We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
My name is Taryn, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 15, 2013. So I was fortunate enough to just have taken my 10th birthday. I came into the rooms when I was very young. When I was 17 years old, I kind of had already had enough and walked myself right into an AA meeting. I was just the definition of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. My upbringing as a child and as a young, I guess, adolescent was kind of filled with the constant idea that I had to take care of myself, that no one really had my back, that everything was on me, everything was my responsibility. I would say that starting from birth, I essentially was on my own. My mother was shot when she was pregnant with me, and this led to her becoming severely addicted to various pain medications and kind of exacerbated mental illness issues that she was having. And she really couldn't take care of me. Her arm was held together with metal rods. And as I mentioned, she was kind of always under the influence. From as early as I can remember, I just wasn't really allowed to have feelings or needs, didn't actually learn how to respond to any kind of like emotional or social cues. If anything, I started taking care of my mom from the early age of 5, 6, and 7. I can remember her sending me with a note to the liquor store to pick her up cigarettes or distributing her medications to her because she was so out of it, she would take the wrong things. And so that was kind of like my idea of what it meant to be parented, was essentially that it was my job to parent my parent. And so to kind of fast forward a little bit, when I was about 9 years old, my mom was in a domestic violence relationship, and she had, like I said, because she had been shot, she ended up winning like this huge settlement. And so we would move from place to place, and she would fully furnish an apartment, and then we would move again, and she would fully furnish another apartment, and we would move again, and she would cycle boyfriends through each different apartment. And so because of that, I ended up going to like 18 different elementary schools. I never really had like a core set of friends. I never really stayed anywhere long enough to kind of get acquainted or adjusted or have any kind of stability. And in third grade, my mother's boyfriend ended up just totally beating the crap out of me. And because of that, I ended up going into foster care. And at the time, I think, you know, it was one of the more devastating things that had ever happened to me, because I missed my mom. And I also really lacked the capacity to understand that my mom played a role in that. And so I very much kind of resented the legal system, resented the police, resented foster care. But shortly after being in like a group home, I went to go live with my dad and my grandmother. And from then on, like for a little while, everything seemed kind of normal. My dad was kind of like super blue collar, Midwestern kind of workaholic, alcoholic kind of guy. And my grandmother also raised me. She had kind of a similar disposition, went to work every day, drank her beer at night or whatever. But what I do remember is that they were very much kind of trying to create some kind of structure or some kind of stability for me. And so I can remember, like, for the first time, you know, being sent outside to go play or like actually being present at school every day. And they would say, you know, you should learn an instrument and you should play a sport and you should, you know, go on play dates with people. And this was all stuff that by the age of 10, I hadn't done any of that stuff. I didn't really know how to be a kid. And so it made me terribly uncomfortable to be around others. I felt like I couldn't be myself. I couldn't be honest. I didn't know how to communicate. I didn't really know what kids were into or like just didn't know how to behave. And so from the get-go, I definitely felt different then and felt isolated and absolutely not connected to really anyone. So going through school for me, I just always felt like I was never gonna actually fit in or I was never actually gonna like feel better. And when I was in seventh grade, my mom ultimately ended up taking her own life. And being a 12-year-old girl is already probably like the hardest thing ever on the planet, right? You're getting bullied and you've got like hormones and, you know, you're very angsty. And so to add on all of this trauma on top of that experience that already kind of sucks, it just created this like perfect wind or this perfect storm rather for me, where my first reaction was to get relief. And so very, very early on in my drinking and using, I kind of just like escalated very rapidly. I don't actually even remember starting with alcohol. I went straight to hard drugs. And I can remember being a freshman in high school and being in the National Honor Society and the California Scholarship Federation. And I played orchestra and I was doing all of these things, but I was doing hard drugs. And I always kind of had this idea deep down that education was going to be my escape plan, or if I was ever going to do anything with my life, it was going to be kind of via this, you know, path to education. And so for a lot of years, I felt like I was this quote unquote gifted student. I really didn't try very hard. I would show up to class drunk or loaded. And I can remember one time walking into class super late with my sunglasses on, just kind of like stormed through the door and took a chemistry exam, which super hard, and just failed and ended up getting an A on that test. And I kind of was able to just do whatever I wanted because of that, right? Like I kept my grades up and I managed to fool everyone that I was going to be this like successful person that I just kind of, I guess, seemed like an asshole, or I don't even know. But because of that, like my behavior absolutely went unchecked. My dad, as I mentioned, was a total workaholic. So he was working in the oil refineries and in the oil rigs and would be gone 60, 70 hours a week and had never really had to take care of anything because his mother was responsible for everything his entire life until she passed away when I was in 10th grade. So when she passed away, I kind of then became, again, a second caregiver for a parent. And 15, 16 years old was like writing the checks for our bills and ordering pizza to make sure that we had dinner and getting a job so that I could pay to go to prom or have a yearbook or do any of these things, because I just didn't have that active parental role in the household. And because he was never there and he was an alcoholic, I was able to kind of do whatever I wanted. I would just go to punk shows and end up in completely different cities. I didn't have a license, didn't know how I was going to get home. I would just get in random people's cars and somehow, some way make it home as a 16, 17-year-old girl. And looking back on that now, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so terrifying. I would die if my kids did some of the stuff that I did. But I just didn't have that perspective of what it meant to live with integrity and what it meant to live with honor and what it meant to be safe. And for me, taking those risks gave me that excitement and that joy of feeling like I was doing something with my life, because I just felt so hopeless. I knew that I always wanted to go to college, but somewhere along the way, my alcoholism and my addiction had just completely taken me on this super dark path. There's this part in the big book, in one of the stories in the back of the book, it says something to the effect of like, the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic is that a non-alcoholic will change their behavior to meet their goals, and an alcoholic will change their goals to meet their behavior. And I remember the first time I read that, it resonated with me really deeply, because I had all of these goals and aspirations, right? To do something, to be in higher education, to have some kind of meaningful career, to make something of myself. And I was good at it too. I got good grades. Like, I did really well. I didn't have to try super hard, but day in and day out, I would kind of modify those goals to meet my behavior, right? All of a sudden, like, it's not so important for me to make it to class, or it's not so important for me to do that homework or show up to the SATs or whatever it was. I just couldn't get it together enough to actually show up for those things anymore. And so by the skin of my teeth, I somehow graduated. I remember they put me in I went from being in all AP classes and honors to being in the remedial truancy school in the bungalows, and just kind of this like fall from grace, I guess, if you will. And I had been arrested multiple times by the time I graduated. I can remember one time having an actual probation officer on my high school campus and having to sign in with her every day, and then getting arrested again, and being in the city jail wearing my high school uniform and getting busted for sales, and thinking like, okay, this is it. This is the end of the line. The officer that arrested me told me, you're going to big girl jail, right? Because it was a few days after my 18th birthday, and reality had set for me. I thought, okay, this is it. Whatever it was I thought I was going to be able to do, I'm now on this other path. And so from that moment forward, the rest of my story is just like a long, long string of incarceration, arrests, abuse, rehabs, detoxes, psych wards, like you name it. It seems all like a blur now, but I couldn't find the willpower to want to do anything, to live. I just couldn't imagine dealing with any more of the pain and the heartache of what it felt like to kind of be in that body, like to have that experience that I had had up until that point. Around the time that I was 20, I had been in AA for, I want to say, like 3 years. And by some fluke, I came to AA and found a heroin addiction. And so that absolutely kind of brought me to my knees and to this just utter sense of desperation that I had never really experienced before. I was like just absolutely ill, and my skin was yellow, and I was probably about 98 pounds at 5'8", just a walking skeleton at that point. And I just remember feeling relief though. Like, I, despite basically being on death's door, I just remember how quiet my mind was and how at ease I felt and how minimal pain I felt. And so for me, that experience was worth it. And any time that I would try to get sober, I would pop into detox, or I would try my best to get into rehab, and I would get sober and I would start to feel a little bit better. But mentally, I was just a wreck. And I was in so much pain emotionally that the decision to get loaded was always the better decision, because why would I want to be sober and be so miserable? I would absolutely rather follow this path of the drink and the drug to ensure that I had this peace of mind that I so desperately craved. And And so I stayed out for many years. The only thing that I did right in that period of time was that I never, ever stopped going to meetings. I had fallen in with an amazing group of people in the program who would take me out for coffee or take me to get a burger after a meeting or drive me wherever I needed to go, check me into rehab. These people suited up and showed up for me for so many years. For 9 years, I took newcomer chips. I just could not get it together. I felt like I couldn't give up these things that I thought I had in my life. At that point, I had still been really great at getting jobs. I could just walk into a place and schmooze someone and get a job. And I would use that job to kind of fund my habit. And I also had a long-term boyfriend during that period of time. And so we very much enabled each other and had this kind of sick Sid and Nancy type of relationship where I would go away to treatment and he would stay loaded, or then he would get clean and I would get loaded, or it was just this chaotic experience. But anytime anyone would ask me, do you want to go back into treatment? Do you want to move somewhere? Do you want to do something else to kind of put yourself in a different situation? And I would always say, I can't leave this ex-boyfriend of mine, or I can't give up my apartment, or I can't give up this job, or any of these things. When the reality is I couldn't hold on to any of those things anyway. Like, I was constantly starting over. I can't even tell you how many times I had to start over. And so I absolutely see now that I was completely delusional and unwilling to get help. And as I mentioned, I think for me, at that point, being in the program for 8-9 years, I had seen that it worked. I knew that it worked. I fully believed to my innermost self that if I did the steps and I took direction, that I too would be able to have a life that I couldn't have imagined, but it still just seemed too hard. And I didn't actually have a will to live. So the likelihood that I was going to actually do the work was so small, right? And so I don't know how or where or when I found the desire to actually keep going. But something, somewhere I had learned, you know, that I just needed to keep putting my feet in front of the other and showing up to meetings and being vulnerable and telling people, you know, what was really going on with me. And so these people stuck around. They stayed by my side. When I was 25, I managed to put together 6 months sober for the first time. I had gone to this outpatient program or something, and the boyfriend at the time was still getting loaded and I was sober, and it seemed like a really good idea for me to use the opportunity to lure him to me by getting loaded. And so in my sick mind at the time, that made so much sense. And so that helped me, or enabled me, to kind of get on this one last relapse. And within a matter of 2 weeks, I had committed an armed robbery, two armed robberies on the same day. And it was not cute. I was on a beach cruiser with a pocket knife. I was about 90 pounds. I had half my head was shaved. I was wearing like a huge, huge hoodie in the middle of summer. It was just this like super pitiful sight. I can't even fully describe what it must have looked like to see me do these armed robberies. And what do? I get on my bicycle and I ride my bike all the way to Wilmington so that I can score. And later that evening, I end up getting pulled over by a police officer, and I just ran for it. I found some different alleys and cut over this fence, and my belt loop got stuck on the top of the fence, and I didn't weigh enough to actually like get myself down from the top of this fence. So I had to kind of break the pocket, like the belt loop of my shorts. And then there were people watching me, and I made up this whole excuse about how my ex-boyfriend was chasing me and they just needed to like help me out. And of course they called the police like a normal person would. And within a matter of moments, there were 6 police cars surrounding me, and I was off to jail yet again. Only this time it was pretty serious because it was armed robbery. And I remember going in front of the judge and begging him for a rehab. And he said, "You were in my courtroom a year ago and I gave you a rehab and you couldn't finish it. And now, you know, you're here for something really serious." And I remember my lawyer or my public defender saying to me, 2 strikes and you're out. And I didn't know what that meant, but I had, I guess, taken a deal to get 2 strikes for these 2 armed robberies. And I ended up going to state prison. And as much as I know about mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex, like I hate to admit that prison changed my life, but it absolutely did. Going to prison gave me the opportunity to finally let my brain kind of settle and to get enough physical sobriety to be able to kind of put together the pieces of all the different things that I had learned over the years and to really find that willingness to want to live, but also to want to be like a woman of integrity and a woman of grace. And I don't know how it even happened, because I didn't have, you know, I didn't have contact with the outside. I didn't have phone calls or visits or any of that stuff. But somewhere along the way, I had kind of had this shift in my perspective. And I'll never forget, there was a time when a woman kind of slammed a door on me. And in any other instance, I would have just completely lost it, right? Like, because she had disrespected me and, you know, how could she do that? And I was going to have to say something about it. But in that moment, the first thing that I thought to myself was like, wow, she must be having a pretty crappy day. And that's not me, right? Like, that's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that teaches me that other people's shit is not my shit. And how can I be useful to my fellows? And that little act kind of set this ball in motion of me having more empathy for others, me not taking other people's, the way people behaved didn't impact me so much. I didn't take things so personally anymore. And I had read this book where it talked about the Stanford Prison Experiment and how if you put apples in a bad barrel, that people aren't bad apples, that people get put into a bad barrel, essentially that they are like a product of their environment. And that was the first kind of time that I ever believed that there wasn't something inherently wrong with me, that I wasn't a bad apple, so to speak, that I did have this kind of divine light and this beautiful spirit inside of me that had just been trampled all over my entire life, and that there was something that I could do about it. All of a sudden, now I kind of have this resolve of, okay, I get to rewrite my story. And so I get out of prison, and I wish that I could say that from then on out, I started making these amazing, beautiful choices, but that's not my story either. I got out and I went to this cool Jewish rehab, and within 2 days I had met the newest newcomer possible. And within a month and a half, we were pregnant, and we were pregnant with twins, because I'm an overachiever that way, I guess. And now I have these 2 like rehab babies. And it's another one of those moment of truth. I really believe that had this been any other time in my history, I would have been furious. And I would have, when I got caught or when they found out I was pregnant, that I would have just completely lost my mind and blamed them and, you know, not been able to take responsibility. But I can remember going in there and having that dignity and having that grace and asking them, hey, I messed up. Is there any way that I could stay for the rest of the week so that I can figure out the next place for me to go? And they allowed me to do that. And I was able to kind of get the ball rolling and fall into this other trajectory. And it was hard. I mean, I was now pregnant with twins and going to some outpatient clinic in downtown LA and living in a sober living in South Central, but I didn't have a car. My doctor's office was in Hollywood. My meetings were in Long Beach. Dude was still living in Santa Monica or working and living in Santa Monica. It was just absolute chaos, but I just kept doing what I was supposed to do. I didn't miss my meetings. I consistently met with my sponsor. I tried my best to take direction. My life was kind of in shambles again, only this time I believed that if I just kept doing what I was supposed to do, that things would get better. And slowly, slowly, Jude moved out of rehab. We ended up running a sober living together. And then we got our first apartment. And then we moved from there. And all along the way, there were all these different trials and tribulations, but there was like the backbone of AA holding me together and these amazing relationships and sponsorship relationships and meetings that were kind of this structure that was keeping me together. And unfortunately, my kid's dad didn't stay sober. And that was a really difficult time for me. I had these two new babies. I didn't have any family support. And I didn't know what I was going to do. But I knew that I had to be a good example of the program. And I knew that no amount of guilt and shame was going to like make him act better or get sober. And so I tried to take the direction of my sponsor, my grand sponsor, which was basically to mind my own business and keep my side of the street clean and keep going about the things that I need to do for my sanity and for my sobriety and, you know, for the safety and security of my kids. And that absolutely saved my butt. I kept my butt in a meeting as every single day that I could. I would take my little double stroller and roll my infants into so many meetings and just pass these babies around the meeting because I was so desperate for a solution and that connection. And I knew that I didn't have the answers. And I'm so grateful for the way that I was introduced to the steps in this last bout of sobriety, because there's this way that my home group does it where they add a bridge between the third and the fourth column where we look at if we were this person with their fears and their insecurities or their upbringing, could I have done to them what they did to me? And 9 times out of 10, the answer was yes, right? And so I was able to take a look at some of those early, early resentments, those justified resentments, those times where I had been a victim, and really start to do some actual house cleaning. I know that those particular types of resentments were always very hard for me because I couldn't find my part in it, right? Like, what part do I have in getting the shit kicked out of me when I was 8 years old? None, clearly. But my role in it was that I continued to carry that stuff around with me and let it continue to ruin my life. And so there was an inability for me to kind of let go of it. But in this last time of doing my steps and really taking a look at like, what kind of upbringing did my mom have? How was she raised? What was she going through that caused her to behave the way that she did or caused my dad to behave the way that he did? And I started to have a little bit of compassion, a little bit of empathy for what they had gone through. And slowly, slowly, a lot of the pain had kind of started to melt away. And I felt myself getting a little bit softer and a little bit kinder and a little bit less controlling. And the steps absolutely provided me with that sense of calm and serenity that I had always craved in this chaotic upbringing that I had had. I finally was able to just see things for what they really were instead of inferring all of this other stuff about what I thought people believed about me or what I thought people's intentions were or how I thought my behavior had been interpreted by others. And know that I was doing what I needed to do and that my intentions were good and that it wasn't really up to me how other people interpreted what I was doing. And with that, I found a lot of freedom and a lot of grace to get to try to be something different, something other than what I thought that I was worth. And so when my kids were about a year and a half, I think they were about a year and a half old, I said to myself, you know, why haven't I gone back to school? It's this thing that I absolutely love. And there's really no reason that I haven't done it except for that it's going to be hard. And what kind of example is that going to set for my kids that if there's something that you really love and you're really good at it, but it's going to be hard, like you just aren't going to do it. So I enrolled in school. And it was absolutely terrifying because I didn't have financial aid and, you know, things were still very much a mess and dude was still not sober. But I just knew that that was kind of the only way that I was ever going to get ahead, especially with a criminal record like mine. To have a criminal record and have no education is just like being a double winner. Like there's no way I was going to be able to provide a life for my kids with those credentials. And so after going back to school, things were still super hard for me. My kid's dad needed to go to rehab and I had totaled my car on the freeway and we had gotten evicted from our apartment or it was like a pay or quit kind of thing because we were a month-to-month lease. And so all of a sudden, I'm in my first semester of college and I've got these two babies and no car and no dude. And all of a sudden, I need to move. And it was a really terrifying time for me. And I could have easily like thrown in the towel and been like, okay, I guess this like really wasn't the best time for me to go to school. Or like, I guess, you know, things just aren't going to work out for me. But I stayed honest with the people around me and I stayed accountable and I made sure that I was checking in and asking for help, which is something that I never really wanted to do. I always, you know, pegged myself as being someone who was super independent and self-sufficient and I didn't need or want anyone's help because then you could let me down. But in these times, I absolutely needed help and the people in the rooms showed up for me time and time again. And I have to say that any notion that I had that there wasn't a higher power was completely squashed in these moments, right? Because like any and every obstacle that I had was completely removed from my path. And I can remember getting that first report card and seeing the straight A's and just being like, oh my God, I totally did it. What the hell? You know, I started to have a little bit of confidence and a little bit of kind of giving myself that attaboy that I always wanted, that pat on the shoulder that I always wanted, and it giving me the fuel to continue going. And so I kept going to meetings. I kept going to college. I started sponsoring girls. Sure enough, graduated from the community college and started going to state college. And all of these really cool things happened. And I had won these scholarships and like did a TEDx and applied to grad school. And it just was like one thing after another. Like I had developed this momentum that just kind of like propelled me into this completely different life that I couldn't have imagined. And today I'm in a PhD program and I look around at some of my colleagues and I'm just like, oh my gosh, if they only knew me 10 years ago, like if they knew that I was like some street kid, punk rock junkie, you know, like, would they respect me? Would they, you know, value my opinion or value my research? And it's been a really cool thing to kind of live the traditions, because I get to teach the people around me, you know, in at work or you know, in school or in the various things that I'm doing, get to show people how I've learned to have a more positive disposition, how to get through things that are uncomfortable, how to be resilient, how to be tenacious, how to have that grit, how to shoot for the stars and really achieve anything that you want to achieve. And they don't have alcoholism, or they don't have this outlet that we get, which is to have people to touch base with and to check in with and to bounce bad ideas off, and to do that constant house cleaning to figure out, you know, who we are and what our motives are and what we want out of life, and how are we treating people, and how does my behavior impact others? How is this decision going to impact, you know, the next thing? And all of these tools that I've learned in the rooms have absolutely helped me be a better employee, a better friend, a better daughter, a better mother. I don't think that I could be any of those things if it wasn't for the program of recovery that I've been gifted with. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know what else to say. Let's see.
You said a lot. I'm going to have to listen to it a few more times. You just had a great run of wisdom back to back.
I don't know really what else to say.
I can ask you a few questions if you're ready.
Yeah.
Okay. That was fun to listen to, Taryn. Thank you. I have so many questions that I have to figure out which ones to start with, because I won't be able to get to all of them, I'm sure. But the one that's popping out to me right now, well, let's start with what you were just saying. You're in a PhD program. Can you tell us what you study, just for visual into
So I am in a PhD in organizations, and I now am studying stigma and discrimination and upward mobility. And what's really cool is that my lived experience of being a formerly incarcerated person, you know, with this kind of sordid background, and having gone through an undergrad business program, realizing that majority of these companies are not going to hire me, it kind of gave me this fuel and this passion to want to pursue helping these folks get better employment, or looking at the ways in which the population is still being stigmatized. And it's been really interesting to have the opportunity to talk to people in business schools about people who have had completely different lives than they've lived, and to kind of give them the opportunity to think about it from a different perspective, so that when my students, you know, my MBA students are going to go and they're going to be CEOs, or they're going to be owners or managers of these different companies, and they'll then now have a different kind of perspective of who these people are that are coming before them to get a job or to get a raise or to kind of get these different opportunities. So it's been really exciting to see how I've been able to kind of bring my personal life into my career and have an impact in that way.
A woman of integrity and grace, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So when you were describing tenacious and having grit and resilience and all of that, I'm like, yes, 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 yes. These are our similar characteristics in the room. When we set our mind to getting high, or getting out of ourselves, or drinking, escaping, there is nothing that will stop us. And when we take that tenacity and put it towards something positive, we can have that same drive. And I love that in your first semester, like Murphy's Law, just all the shit went bad and you were just like, nope, I'm going to power through. And you did, and you asked for help. And then your higher power showed itself in, and sticking with it.
Yeah, totally. It's been so rad.
Because the other side of our tenacity, for me anyway, is my ability to victimize myself. So either I'm going to be tenacious and get the hell out of my way, or I'm going to be a victim and everyone's going to hear about it because did you see what happened to Tara?
Right.
And we don't have to, I don't have to be either. But when there's something we really want, when I started, keep coming back, when I started this podcast, which I don't really consider a podcast, I consider it more of like a speaker tape, but I told my husband, I'm like, I have to do 6 episodes. Do not let me quit until after 6 episodes. No matter what excuse I give you, I'm going to do 6. And you're going to be episode 195. So
wow.
I'm like, I'm going to keep going.
Yeah.
It's good stuff. I love that you are putting your experience to make the world a better place and helping other people with your sorted background. There's so many questions. I've stopped talking about myself. So why?
No, you're good.
Why AA and not NA? I ask this question a lot when people have drugs in their background, and the answer is always a little bit different, but sometimes it's worth asking.
Yeah, totally. So I feel like over the years, a lot of people have asked me, you know, why do you go to AA instead of NA? And I absolutely did try NA meetings and have the NA literature, but it never fully resonated with me. The thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that I identified with what was in the book and I related to the stories of the people in the book. And I never, you know, I always identify as an alcoholic. I never identify as an addict. I feel like my drug addiction or heroin specifically was just like my favorite brand of alcohol. Hmm. I always started with alcohol for the first, you know, I want to say the first 5 to 10 years of my addiction, I absolutely was the chick that was going to drink you under the table. And my handle on social media has part of my drinking name from when I was in high school. I would just walk around with a gallon of orange juice. I would pour half of it out and dump in a liter of vodka and walk around the party drinking a whole handle of vodka. Like there was nothing wrong with that picture. I always loved the relief that I got from the first sip of alcohol. And unfortunately, you know, I replaced that addiction with that of opiates, but the way that I felt and the way that I identified never changed. Everything about who I was and all of those aspects of the ism were the same regardless of which substance I was putting into my body. And the thing that I love about our literature is that the literature itself doesn't discriminate at all. There's so many references. I actually write it in my big book because I end up getting a lot of sponsees that have serious drug addictions. So I have made an index on the front page of my big book of all of the different references to drugs and people using sedatives to be able to drink more, people using uppers, people doing intravenous drugs, all in the big book. And the thing that I'll usually kind of highlight is that one of the things that I would say is like one of the more popular things we read about acceptance is the answer. The first title of that story was Dr. Alcoholic Addict, right? And so that idea that they have to be separate, in my opinion, is kind of silly. And I just always have found the solution in AA and never really felt like I needed to go anywhere else to get it, because the solution I found in AA is the one that worked for me.
It's so common. It's so common. So when you share in an AA meeting, so you obviously identify as an alcoholic, and I've heard others that have both in their story kind of talk about this umbrella term where alcoholic is an umbrella term and includes all of these other substances as well. And I love that image because it covers everything. But what confuses me is why do we separate it? At what point? And when? Well, that's not what I was going to say. Yes, that confuses me. But so you identify as an alcoholic when you go to a meeting. When you tell your story like you have today, do you normally curate it and leave out any mention of drugs in an AA meeting?
No, I never change my story based on where I am. Hell, I don't even know what I'm going to, I have no idea what I'm going to share in any meeting I'm going to be in, but I certainly don't ever remove any kind of mention of drugs or other outside issues. Because I don't feel like it's super important.
So then my other thing is, and you may know this, you've been around a bit longer. Happy 10 years, by the way.
Thank you.
Do you know why there is the hard and fast meetings that will like pull you aside and tell you not to talk about drugs and say alcohol only? Like what did they do when NA didn't exist? Actually, we were just reading this tradition in my Friday morning meeting. Now that I think about it.
I don't know. Well, and I do think it's interesting that Dr. Paul, who wrote Acceptance is the Answer, actually essentially founded like Pills Anonymous and probably led, I don't know if that led to the creation of Narcotics Anonymous or what have you, but he essentially said the same thing. He didn't actually even go to those other programs because he felt like he got what he needed from AA. And I really kind of value that perspective of maybe there are other people outside of AA that feel like they can identify with the notion of, you know, being an alcoholic. And so maybe it's for their benefit that there are these other programs so that they have a place where they feel like they can identify. They can call themselves, you know, Cocaine Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous or Pills Anonymous or whatever anonymous. It gives them a place where they can kind of find a solution. But as for why do we in Alcoholics Anonymous feel the need to limit what and how people share, I really couldn't put my finger on it. And that's why I always make it a point to share about the parts of the book that mention drugs, right? Because these people back when the program was designed were doing drugs. And so I think at some point it's just a matter of like semantics. And I do understand the value of leaving out outside issues, but I don't, and I have never felt like drugs were an outside issue. And I guess, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess, yeah, I really couldn't tell you. I don't know why it's a thing. To me, it's the strangest thing because why then are the references to drugs all throughout our book?
I mean, I'm pretty sure Dr. Bob was shooting up drugs in his car before he got out of his car to go into his house like every night. Wasn't that in Dr. Bob's story?
Yes.
So, yeah.
But like I said, I do understand. And here's the thing. I think if I had to guess, in general terms, a lot of old timers are probably tired of hearing people come into meetings and talk about what it was like. And I think that by making some kind of distinction about your alcoholism or about the drugs that you used or about these like little details, maybe there's this underlying assumption that it detracts from the solution or, you know, what brought you to the point of needing that solution. And so maybe the hope is that we don't kind of harp on what things were like, but I don't know. That might be like a huge stretch. I don't subscribe to it. I definitely think drugs and alcohol are the same thing.
So for our listeners, that's our roundabout way of saying it's all the same thing. We do not discriminate. Tolerance and love of others is our code.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why did you walk yourself or talk me through this? I walked myself into an AA meeting at 17 years old. How'd you even know to go?
So My Eskimo was a girlfriend of mine who was maybe a year younger than I, and she might have been on a court card, or I believe her dad was already in the program, and so she was already going to meetings, and I needed a ride from her. So I actually asked her, you know, can you give me a ride to such and such, whatever? And she's like, yeah, I need to go to this meeting. If you go with me, then I'll drive you after. I'm like, okay. And so I went with her to this AA meeting. I was under the bridge, and I remember seeing all these people that I thought looked super cool, that they were like all tattooed, and it seemed like everyone was all friends with each other. And they were talking about, you know, they were going to all these punk shows and they were going to go out to dinner after. And there was something really appealing about the actual group of people that I first encountered when I got to AA that kind of sparked an interest. Now, for the first year, I absolutely didn't know if I was even going to try to do the program, so to speak. I had a friend of mine who basically bullied me into getting a sponsor. She was like, if you don't ask that girl to be your sponsor, like, I'm just going to be your sponsor. And so I kind of, like, you know, with my tail between my legs, like, walked through this house party and asked this woman to be my sponsor. And from there, like, I kind of just had started to scratch that itch of like, okay, maybe I identify. Like, I know there's something wrong with me, but like, maybe what's wrong with me is the same thing that's wrong with these people. And maybe that is going to be my way to finally find this relief that I'm craving, right? Because they all seem like they got things going on and they are getting these little slivers of peace that I want so badly. And so I just ended up sticking around.
I'm glad you did.
Me too.
Your children are 9, 10 now?
They're eight.
Okay.
Yes.
So you were 12 when your mom committed suicide and about 15 when your grandmother died. And I don't know if your father's still alive or if you lost him as well.
No, my dad is very much alive, but he's not so much in the picture. My dad is currently struggling from alcoholism and homelessness. So it's been a bit of a journey. It's definitely one of those resentments that I have to continue working on and continue, you know, having good boundaries and continue to offer him the grace that I needed and to remind myself that I still have a job. My job is to like be a good daughter to him and to not have expectations of how I hope he will behave or how I think he should behave or how, you know, what type of grandparent he should be to my kids. I know that he's suffering and I just try to be like the best daughter that I can be for him in whatever capacity that looks like.
So your kids are 8 and you are in a PhD program and you've been sober their whole life.
Yeah.
Does it seem difficult or challenging to raise them when you don't really know what that a healthy version of that looks like?
Yeah, I would absolutely say that raising kids or just being a mom and not ever having really had a mom or not even knowing what a mom does or how a mom behaves or how a mom feels. Like, I didn't have any of that stuff modeled to me. And I was definitely very concerned about it when the kids were little. I was so afraid of making a mistake and so afraid of, you know, screwing them up. And I think having my kids has been ultimately like one of the best healing experiences ever, because I get to kind of heal my inner child by giving them the childhood that I would have wanted, or giving them the space to figure out who they want to be and allow them the space to have their feelings and, you know, talk with them about what they like and what they don't like and how they're feeling. And I am so overwhelmed every single day and absolutely overstimulated. And, you know, it's just absolute chaos all the time. But I know that in my innermost self, like, I am doing everything I can to be a good mom. And although I didn't have a great role model, I have been able to learn a lot from the women around me and my great friendships that I've developed in the rooms, and my sponsor and some of the old timers have taught me how to be a good mom and have taught me how to think about what it means to be a mother and what it means to raise children and how to make those difficult decisions and feel comfortable in making those decisions and knowing that I have their best interest at heart. And the joy that I get from knowing that my kids have never seen me loaded is just insurmountable. I couldn't even imagine what it would be like to bring my kids through my addiction with me. And every day is a different day. They give me a lot of new challenges and they give me a lot of great opportunities to work the principles in all the areas of my life. And I couldn't have asked for a better situation. It wasn't ideal, right? Like, no one wants to get pregnant in rehab fresh out of prison. Like, it is with a newcomer, no less. Like, it couldn't have been a less ideal situation, but it has given me so much more than I ever could have wanted out of life.
I think of all of the women in the rooms as like old grandmothers and aunties that I don't have. And they walk me through the silliness and the seriousness of being a mother.
Absolutely.
They're there for all of the phases of our life. There's the ability to just raise our hand and say, I don't know how to do this. How did you do it?
Right.
How do people get through life without a whole group of women to do that with them?
No, it's totally bananas. Like, it doesn't make sense to me that anyone can really do anything without having someone to check their decisions with.
And all of the stuff at the end of your share, right after you said tenacious and grit and resilience, and then figure out who we are and figure out the decision and know what it impacts. And like, you went on a little, I don't have a more positive word, but a little rant. And it was so good. It was so good. It was like, yes, yes, the program does that. And yes, it does that. And yes, I was just like checking off in my head. I couldn't write it all down. But you did a great job at the end of your share, throughout the whole share, but certainly at the end, just firing off all of these things that the rooms and the people in the rooms and our work give us to live this human life, which is really, really hard in the beginning for some of us, especially you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Is there anything that you're thinking of now that you didn't share, or anything you left out that you'd like to share?
I don't know, dude. I'm such a space cadet. I don't even remember what I said.
Well, you'll hear it again. You'll hear it again.
I'm sure it's fine.
All right. And before I ask my last question, I'm sure there are some listeners. Are your kids boys or girls?
Oh my gosh, how funny. I have a boy and a girl because I'm an overachiever and I wanted to get it all done in one shot. My friends are always like, of course you had twins. You know, what's funny is actually last winter, we finally decided to adopt a dog. The kids had been wanting a dog for a really long time. And we're like, okay, let's do it. Like, let's get a dog. And so we adopt this dog. And within about a week or two, we realized that she's getting awfully plump. And I'm thinking, you know, she just, you know, she was malnourished. She was living on the streets or whatever. Like, now she's eating good and she's gaining some weight. No, she was pregnant and she ended up being pregnant with 7 puppies. And so now then here I am in my little tiny student housing apartment with a huge box, a whelping box where like whelped an entire litter of puppies. And for 6 weeks, 7 weeks, we have all these puppies running around my apartment because who doesn't need an entire litter of puppies while you're starting out in a PhD program? Like, who else would that happen to?
Only the mother of twins.
100%. Who thrives in chaos.
That's right. Oh, not like the chaos of your childhood, the chaos of drinking and using. It's a beautiful, beautiful, manageable chaos. You're giving your kids such a great childhood.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Final question for those out there listening that are perhaps still suffering, what message would you like to leave them with?
I guess if I had to leave a message for people who are still suffering, it would just be to not give up no matter what, and to not worry so much about what you think other people are thinking about you or what you think people in the rooms are thinking about you. Like, the awesome thing about our program is that there are a bajillion meetings at any given day and in any city at any time. And if you go to a meeting and you don't like what you hear, like, you can try another one. And if you have a sponsor and you don't necessarily feel like it's jiving, like, you can get a new sponsor. If you feel like you didn't get the relief that you were hoping to get after you did your steps, like, you can do your steps again. Like, there isn't one right way to do this program. And the only thing that I feel like contributed to me finally getting my first year of sobriety after a decade of newcomer chips is that I kept showing up no matter what. And I wasn't afraid of what people thought. And I was willing and somehow capable to be vulnerable enough and to be transparent enough and to really express that, like, even though I wasn't sure if I wanted what was in the room and I wasn't sure if I wanted to do the work that it was going to take to have a different life, like, I knew that there was a part of me that wanted to keep living, and that was the only thing that kept me going. So for people who feel like maybe AA isn't the right place for them, or, you know, they haven't gotten that relief in the steps, like, I just always recommend that people keep going, try something different, find your people, be vulnerable, and never, never accept, you know, that your life has to be this dark, gloomy piece of shit. Like, you can have whatever life you want. You're just going to have to do some work, and you're going to have to be vulnerable. But it's here if you want it.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, or visit keepcomingback.net.